All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Saul Wolf and Serrano Show here on WWDB Talk 860. We've got a fantastic broadcast. Today's show, featuring our host, John Cervantes, is going to be about medical malpractice, something that John specialized in and has decades worth of experience. And it's a very specialized area of personal injury law. First, let me welcome our host, John Cervantes, who's a partner at Saul Wolf and Serrano's, to the show. John, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you, Joe. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. And having said that, let's get right into it. How long have you specialized in medical malpractice?
That's a loaded question. I've been doing medical malpractice for potentially 30 years, but I would say the focus of my personal practice is probably the last 20 years.
And I know specialized probably isn't the right term, especially legally, but having said that, I know the firm does.
I can clarify that.
Go ahead.
You know, I was asked one time, what do you spend most of your time on? And what are most of your cases about? And I said, well, I spend most of my time on medical malpractice cases. They're a great majority of my cases, but they also take so much time that 80% of my professional time is dedicated to medical malpractice cases.
And like we were, you know, saying, the firm does, and I know you do, auto, slip and fall, you know, all the standard areas. Also, civil sexual assault is an area that the firm specializes in. And when I say, again, specialize, probably the wrong word, but I'm just saying you represent a number of clients in a wide array of personal injury areas. But as you said, medical malpractice is one of the primary areas that you work because it takes up so much of your time. Having said that, let's dig into it. What led you to specialize in malpractice in Pennsylvania? So many people say they do it, but they don't do it. It is a specialized area. What led you to get into that and represent medical malpractice clients?
I enjoy the medicine. Frankly, we all became lawyers to get away from science and math. And somehow I gravitated back to that. I come from a medical background. My father is a retired physician. And I was around it all my life growing up. I'm comfortable with the world of medicine, at least the personalities and the doctors that will come in front of me, either adversarial or as experts on our behalf. So I'm comfortable with physicians and interacting with them. They can be a tough crowd because, well, I believe they're intellectually on another level than the rest of us, at least when it comes to medicine. So I'm very comfortable with it. I've also had my own personal battles, and my family's had some issues, and when, you know, we've all have our stories to tell, but we all had our experiences with medical crises in our lives, and I find it interesting, so I enjoy it.
What's interesting also is that medical malpractice is a leading cause. I think it's third leading cause of death in the U.S. Why, and what are the leading causes behind that?
Well, there's hospital errors, and this is a debate, and it really kind of falls into a political question. You know, you hear about ERs being understaffed, and there's these long waits in emergency rooms, not because there's no room at the end, but because they don't have enough folks to staff the emergency rooms. And when you don't have enough staff, mistakes are going to occur, and a lot of times they can be deadly. Also, there's medication errors. Things happen. The medical community, in my view, could do a better job governing themselves. You know, it's very difficult to get experts to testify against other doctors. And I understand. I mean, it's not like you can just grab anybody to testify against somebody else. Some of the specialties are very, very protective of doctors in certain specialties. So if you decide you're going to testify against another physician in that like specialty, it can cause you some political problems within that specialty. So, and then you have procedures within medicine where if something happens in a hospital and the hospital then undertakes its own investigation, it's called a peer review. And, you know, what they learn in those peer reviews is oftentimes protected. So if you're a lawyer and you want to get access to that information, you're not permitted to get that information. If the investigation and what they learned during the course of that investigation, those facts were developed in the course of the peer review investigation. So when you have all that protection built in, accountability sometimes suffers. And, you know, accountability is something that kind of is the foundation of what makes this place, you know, our country run.
That was my next question. Accountability, because there's so many moving parts in medicine, obviously, mm-hmm. at a hospital. When you say at a hospital, but also medications, all types of potential medical malpractice. The fact of the matter is that accountability is an absolute necessity.
That people hear that word and they don't realize how significant that is. And that impacts everybody in the marketplace, in the medical community, in the insurance industry. You have to have accountability, because when somebody knows they might be held accountable, you know, it's human nature to some extent. You might just pay that much more attention to what you're doing.
You mentioned, and you and I have done shows with Representative Tariq Khan talking about making sure we have enough personnel in the emergency rooms and a lot of those things. And so I agree with that. There's a million different ways to say that, but a great example would be understaffing, maybe just understaffing, but also understaffing with qualified employees, medical personnel, the emergency rooms and different floors. And so you're right. If there was no accountability, that would be running rampant. And so it's a great, great point. And when we talk about medical malpractice, being one of the leading causes of death in the U.S., it sounds extreme, but so many people use our hospitals and our obviously medical professionals, most of which are great and fantastic, and we're all supportive of them, but accountability is important. What, and we're going to spitfire because we only have a half hour, but I'm going to lead you into this question, but what separates medical malpractice from other types of PI cases, personal injury cases, and why do only a select few firms actually do it? I'm going to jump in and throw an answer out there, and I'd like you to elaborate. These cases have to be certified, right? That is, you know, an area, not too many areas of personal injury need to be certified. Talk about that.
Medicine is one of those areas. In some cases, engineering is another area. If you have a professional and you need a professional's opinion, before you file a lawsuit to allege that the standard of care was not met or breached, you need a physician to execute or sign a document called a letter of reasonable probability, which basically says that they've investigated, they've looked at the records, they've reviewed the allegations, and they believe there's a reasonable probability that the standard of care was not met that led to the injuries that are alleged in the complaint. That sometimes, not sometimes, it always costs money. Sometimes it costs a lot of money, and lawyers will have to spend. I mean, I'll give you an example. I just investigated a case where the initial reaction by my expert was, based on some of the limited materials I had, was that he thought there was a case there. So what we did is we filed a writ of summons, which tolls the statute. That means it's just a document naming a defendant, but not making any allegations to get that defendant. So the doctors put on notice that there's a potential lawsuit coming. And sometimes they put their malpractice carriers on notice. Well, they probably should, regardless. And, you know, it gives the lawyer a little more opportunity to connect the dots, so to speak. And once we got all the records, because this gentleman came to me on the eve of the statute of limitations. So usually I don't get jammed up like that. But this was a situation where somebody came to me, you know, right before their 2-year statute was up. He had devastating damages. I really wanted to help him. And, you know, I was able to get somebody, an expert, on the phone. I was able to get documents to him, whatever we had at the time. So what we filed was a writ. Then when all the records came in, he wasn't able to support the case anymore. And we had to withdraw the action. At least that's what we withdrew the action. But the point of the story is that at the end of the day, we must have spent $10,000 learning that we didn't have a case.
Right. The importance of retaining a law firm that has the resources and the finances to be able to, you know, obviously pay, because this is the contingency fee agreement. There's no out-of-pocket costs up front costs from the client. So medical malpractice attorney like yourself takes a case. You're committing to obviously paying for the experts and doing all that stuff out-of-pocket with the obviously intention of getting reimbursed at the end. But that's only if you win. People don't really always understand what they should be looking for when they get a medical malpractice attorney. Talk about the importance of having the resources and the finances to be able to pay for the experts and do it yet in order to fight and represent your clients in front of a conglomerate of insurance companies.
You asked me, we started this conversation by saying, why do people, only so many people want to get, so many lawyers want to get involved in malpractice? One is the expense. Two is the difficulty. And I'll finish this issue with regard to expenses. You need to be able to fund your cases. And if a firm like ours, it's not like we have one malpractice case. We have, dozens and dozens of them. I would call them, do we have them all in litigation? No, but there's a lot of active malpractice cases and they cost a lot of money. If you don't have the ability to finance and fund those cases, you're not going to be able to do this work. These cases oftentimes will cost six figures even before you get to the courthouse steps. And then just the trial alone can cost $50,000 to $100,000, depending on how many experts you have. You got to bring in your trial people, present your case in front of a jury. It's very, very expensive. And if you lose, the lawyer's eating all of it.
And so having said that, it's definitely an interesting area. And when you think about it, and you think about so many moving parts, okay? One of the questions I have is, how come medical malpractice cases take so long? It's a lot of times these are not only expensive and probably expensive because they do take long, but why in a sense, are they on the longer side often?
Well, because they're complicated. If the court is trying to schedule and give you a trial date, and usually with medical malpractice cases, you don't go into a pool. You get a definitive trial date because you got experts that you're either flying in or coming around you've got to coordinate their schedules with your schedule and the court schedule. So oftentimes just to get a trial date that it can accommodate three or four attorneys and their experts, you have to go down a year and a half just to get a trial date that we can all count on. We know we're going to trial on that day. Whereas you have like an auto accident case, there's not that many parties, not many witnesses. And a lot of the times it's county specific too. Like Philadelphia does a great job in establishing a trial calendar or a schedule leading up to trial. And they pretty much handle that right out of the box so that you know what to expect and how that case is going to go down. A lot of these other counties really don't do a great job. I'm not throwing any particular county under the bus, but Philly's really good. And considering how big a city it is, what they've done in Philadelphia administratively on how to manage and administrate these cases is nothing short of phenomenal. And cases get done because of they don't screw around with trial dates. You got a date, that's the date, and you better be ready. And if you're not ready, figure it out. And if you can't be ready, settle your case. And that helps get cases settled.
Well, it's interesting you say that, John, because one of the things that, you talk about knowing the medicine, okay? How many of these cases actually go to trial? I know we're just, talking about percentages, but in a broad stroke, how many, either settle the ones that are, move forward and those that actually go to court? Is there, a percentage there? Estimated.
Well, if you look at the family of personal injury cases and you ask yourself, what cases are going to go to a court? What cases are going to see the inside of a courtroom? In which cases are not going to be seen inside of a courtroom? The highest probability of a case seeing the inside of a courtroom, and I say inside a courtroom, it means it doesn't necessarily, go to a verdict, because a lot of times you can settle your case once you start it. But what I'm saying is, in malpractice, in the malpractice world, the doctor has to consent to resolving his case. And if they don't get that consent, the insurance company, for the most part, can't attempt to settle the case. And that's usually policy specific. So you have a greater likelihood of trying your medical malpractice case than you do any other type of case. And the reason for that is what I just said. And the other reason for that is the great majority of medical malpractice cases, regardless of how good your case is, result in verdicts in favor of the medical professional, either the doctor or the hospital or the nurses, whatever you have. Because, you know, my theory on that is, one, they're very difficult cases. And if a jury doesn't understand the case, they generally will, their decision will come down in favor of the medical doctor. And that's one of the challenges a lawyer will have, is to dumb it down, so to speak.
Well, John, I was literally just going to say that. In other words, you know, it's hard enough for lawyers to understand. You know, you come from a medical background and you enjoy the medicine, okay? And your years of experience are, you know, very helpful. But a jury, regular folks, you know, this is their first shot. You know, it must be, you know, talk about lack of, you know, dumbing it down, if you will, for lack of a better term. There's got to be some sort of talent in that, I guess, on your on your side, because, you know,
yeah. Well, you say you hit it. You hit the nail on the head. Some of the best lawyers that I've ever seen, you know, they simplify their arguments. They talk to their jury, and they're not talking down to them. They're talking to them. So there's a fine line. It's like dancing on the head of a pin, where you're educating 12 people in that box without trying to lecture to them and try to explain to them, you know, this is complicated stuff. You may not be bright enough to handle it, but I'm going to try to explain it to you. Right. You can't come across that way.
Yeah,
you have to be part of the effort, and you're going to be talking to them, not down at them. Well, and when you master that skill, you're going to win cases.
No question. And it's interesting because, you know, you have a, you know, we only have a couple minutes left in the broadcast, but you have, it's a very, like, if I'm doing a website, I don't call my smart guys up to check it out. I call guys like me, you know, like, are looking at it. And if they can understand it, that's important. And the ability to do that. And so that is something I was jumping through. It was something that was on my mind, and really important, because people often, they don't understand those medical terms and all that. And so it's a very interesting area, and the ability to be able to convey that message and the medicine. John, what should somebody do if they suspect they or a loved one or a victim of medical malpractice?
Well, this is what I tell everybody, because I get phone calls from people who have experienced a bad result. There's a difference between having a bad result and suffering and being a victim of medical malpractice. A bad result can happen. You can have surgery, somebody goes in to tries to fix your back, and you come out of the surgery and you're just not, you're not the way you thought you'd be. Well, you call a lawyer, say, well, I'm still having these problems. Well, that doesn't mean you're a victim of malpractice. It's just, you know, you just didn't get 100%, or you got 80% better, or it just didn't work. So I tell everybody, get all the answers, get second opinions, find out as much as you can about why you're still having a problem before you call a lawyer, because as lawyers, we're not, our job is not to tell you if the doctor, you know, our job is not to diagnose you or give you a prognosis. That's for doctors to do. So get as much information as you can if you think you're a victim of malpractice before you call a lawyer.
Right. And that's my thought process. At the same time, if you were in an auto accident, you would obviously try to look for evidence and exchange information.
Right.
Is there a checklist? Okay.
Well, that's easy though. When you're in an auto accident and somebody rear ends you, you don't need an expert to identify whether or not that driver was careless or not. We all drive cars. We all know you're not supposed to hit somebody in the back end at a stop or look both ways before you cross an intersection. When it comes to medicine, you need experts to tell you if the standard of care was met or not.
And when what you would mention about the statute of limitations, okay? Talk about that and what that is. Because some people, you know, hedge, you know, they don't know whether that, you know, and are going to get better or not. What does that mean?
But that's a tough call. I mean, you have 2 years from the date of the alleged malpractice to file a lawsuit. And that means you can't just call a lawyer up on the 2 year anniversary of your alleged malpractice and think that lawyer is going to be able to file a complaint based on what you're telling him or her. Because that lawyer then has to get the information, then has to investigate it, then has to have it reviewed by a doctor, and then has to file their lawsuit or do what I did in the past and file a writ to preserve the claim until you can make the allegations. But you have 2 years. Now, there is a discovery rule in Pennsylvania which allows you additional time if it was a situation where you could not discover that a mistake was made. And that can occur if somebody missed a pathology or somebody missed something on a diagnostic study, an X-ray, CAT, MRI, that kind of thing. And then you didn't find out about that doctor or that pathologist or that lab person missing that until later. So that sometimes will give you additional time.
And so when we talk about these types of cases, are there mistakes aside from the standard of care that a client can make? What mistakes do people make that can, in a sense, hurt their case? In essence, take them out of the game.
Well, that's an easy one. If you're asking me what you should do if you're a patient and you want to avoid having the finger pointed back at you, you have to be compliant. Don't be non-compliant. If a doctor tells you have to take this medication and these many milligrams twice a day for how many months, and you don't do it and you wind up having a problem, they can point the finger right back at you and say you weren't compliant, or you were supposed to follow up with somebody and you didn't do it, and now you got a bigger problem. That's called non-compliance. That's a great defense for the medical doctor.
And John, talk about the firm. We have about 4 minutes left. The communications. What can people expect if you're representing them when in a medical malpractice case? And we're talking MedMal now. So specifically there, and I know this goes along with the other specialty, the other things you guys do, the other practice areas. Talk about the expectations that people, that they can expect when you're representing them.
Well, they can expect that we're going to turn over every stone and try to learn as much as we can about their particular situation. And by that means, you know, looking at the medical literature, getting the experts to review it. Now, that being said, if there's a situation that's pretty obvious to me that there's no case here, I'm not going to go and invest the money in investigating the case. But if we think it's a case, we're going to spend the money and get the right experts and put it in a position to succeed. And most importantly, we're going to do our very best to try to explain all the issues to our clients as best we can, because the clients need to understand the issues. Because if they don't understand the issues, one, they might not make the right decision when it comes time to potentially resolve their case if they get that opportunity. But they're going to be they're not going to be satisfied. And if they don't understand something, they're going to be dissatisfied with the system. They're going to be dissatisfied with you and your efforts. They're going to be satisfied with your firm. And you want them to walk away knowing how the system worked. And it's the best system we have, in, you know, justice system that we have. And I think it's the, you know, I'm not familiar with all the justice systems in the world, but I think we have a pretty good one here. And you want your client to understand that they were best served by it.
And John, if somebody wants to get in touch, if they want to contact you in a case that they or a loved one has a medical malpractice case, okay. And before I ask that, because how many people often, because they don't understand it, maybe, and they shouldn't, but how many people actually think they have a? I had a buddy of mine call me up one time. He was in the hospital and he was whispering because he said the doctor didn't come in the room two or three times. And I know we're pro medicine. I know that. He's like, I'm going to be suing him for medical malpractice. I'm like, listen, I'm an iron worker, but I can tell you that's not the case. How many people in a sense have no idea what a medical malpractice case is?
I tell my doctor friends all the time, you want to avoid getting sued, have the best bedside manner money can buy. Because yeah. If your patient loves you, they are going to give you the benefit of the doubt forever and a day.
Absolutely.
But if you ignore them or treat Absolutely. Them with disrespect, you got a problem.
Yeah, that's a good
point. And that holds true with all of us, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. John, somebody, like I started out saying, if somebody thinks they have a medical malpractice case, how can they get in touch with you?
SullivanZavanos.com. You'll get our website. You'll get to read about all the attorneys in the office. You get to see who does what best. There's bios on our website, and there's an email that you can use to send to the general box. And I guarantee you somebody will get back to you within 24 hours.
Fantastic. And I'm sure there's a main number there as well. So, John, I want to.
Oh, sure. 215-732-2260.
Fantastic. Listen, I want to thank everybody for tuning into the Sullivan Zavanos Show here on WWDB Talk 860. We want to thank our host, John Zavanos, for the fantastic information. On behalf of John Zavanos, I'm Joe Doherty, and everybody at Sullivan Zavanos, have a great day, everybody.